Hello, and welcome to MomsFightingAutism.com. I'm the moderator this evening. My name is Chantal Cecile Kira. And before I introduce our guest this evening, I wanted to make sure to let people know about some more free information available to you. I now am writing a column for TheExaminer.com. It's a national online newspaper, and I am now the autism and adolescence columnist. So if you go on examiner.com and look up autism and adolescence columnist, that'll be me. But I'm going to spell my name for you in case you would like to look or search for it under my name. So my name is Chantal Cecile Kira, and that is spelled Chantal Cecile-Kira. This evening, I am so happy to present as our guest, Dr. Nick Dubin, who I first met by email, actually, when I was writing my book, Autism Life Skills. I interviewed Nick because I had read a couple of his books, or actually one of his books, but I'd read other things that he had written, and I'd heard very wonderful things about him. The book that I had read was Asperger's Syndrome and Bullying, Strategies and Solutions. So let me tell you a little bit about Dr. Dubin before I introduce him in person over the phone. He just recently received his doctorate, and so I want to extend my congratulations to him. And he was first diagnosed with Asperger's Syndrome in 2004 by a neuropsychologist. Since then, Nick has been a passionate advocate on issues relating to the autism spectrum. Dr. Dubin has a bachelor's degree in communication from Oakland University, a master's degree in special education from the University of Detroit Mercy, and a doctoral degree from the Michigan School of Professional Psychology. Dr. Dubin authored 3 books and produced 3 DVDs, all relating to the autism spectrum. Nick lives in the greater Detroit, Michigan area and currently works on his next book about autism spectrum disorders and depression. For more information, he does have a website that you can visit, which is www.aspergerwisdom.com. And tonight's topic is Asperger's Syndrome and Bullying, based on Nick's book, Asperger's Syndromes and Bullying, which was published in 2007 by Jessica Kingsley Publishers. So in this webinar this evening, we'll be exploring the etiology of bullying among the Asperger population while offering strategies for empowerment geared towards teachers, parents, schools, and individuals with Asperger's themselves. I wanted you to know that statistically, the vast majority of children with Asperger's syndrome will experience frequent bullying. So this seminar, in which he will be answering questions that have been emailed into us, we'll aim to provide real answers to help curb this destructive trend. So welcome, Nick.
Thank you, Chantal.
It's really an honor to have you here.
It's definitely an honor to be with you. I've been an avid reader of all your materials for the past few years since I've become immersed in the world of autism, and it's really great to finally meet you.
Well, I just really enjoyed the information that you share with all of us, because actually I always say that the real experts are people on the spectrum, because you all have lived through it and you've developed the strategies to help get through the situations. Whether or not you knew you had Asperger's at the time, you figured out strategies that helped, or in hindsight you have. Do you want to talk a little bit and tell the audience what books and DVDs you have authored?
Sure. My first book was Asperger's Syndrome and Bullying, as Chantal mentioned, and that was written a few years ago. And what really prompted me to write that book was the realization that so many people like me with Asperger's had gone through similar experiences that I had gone through. And I just thought that so much of an emphasis is placed on the gay population when we talk about bullying. And while that's very important, we also have to keep in mind that anybody, I don't care who you are, but anybody who is going to be perceived as being different from the norm is going to be an easy target for being bullied. And obviously those with autism and Asperger's behave differently. I mean, we have different behaviors that make us stick out in the crowd. So I just thought it was a very timely subject. There hadn't been many books written about it. I think there was one book written by Rebecca Heinrichs, which was an excellent book, and I wasn't looking to kind of duplicate anything that she had done, but I wanted to write from a both a professional perspective and a first-person perspective to kind of add that. And then I also am working – oh, I should just say I just wrote a book on Asperger syndrome and anxiety, and that was released also through Jessica Kingsley Publishers a few months ago. And that's basically a self-help book geared towards adults on the spectrum. My understanding was that there hadn't been a book written specifically geared towards stress management for the adult population, and I thought that was really important because I really haven't met any individuals on the spectrum that don't experience a good deal of anxiety on a daily basis. I think it's, in a way, part and parcel of having Asperger's. And the current book that I'm working on is a book about ASD and depression. In a similar vein to the anxiety book, it's also going to be a self-help guide for individuals on the spectrum as well.
I really am looking forward to reading the Asperger Syndrome and Anxiety Guide. And in fact, for the listeners out there, I will be reviewing the book for my column on theexaminer.com. But you're right, these kind of books are so important, and anxiety is something, and depression are things that the neurotypical population also deals with, but no one's ever really addressed it as a self-help thing for people with, for adults with Asperger's. And it's so important because even, for example, adolescents, neurotypical adolescents all know that going through teenagehood or adolescencehood is hell. So on top of that, if you have Asperger's syndrome and you don't really know how to handle all of these things just through osmosis, it's really nice to have strategies from someone like you who's been there.
Absolutely, and I think the topic is so important because I think just reading a general book on anxiety, if you're somebody with Asperger's, is not going to be good enough. It's not going to give you enough information because it's written towards a specific population. And the fact of the matter is that when you have Asperger's, I truly believe you perceive the world differently, sensory-wise, emotionally, even culturally. I think we have different cultural viewpoints. So our anxiety is going to be exacerbated to some extent, and it's going to be generated by different reasons. And so I think it's really, really important to address specifically the Asperger population when talking about this and not just give general strategies that could be applied to everyone.
One point I wanted to bring up about the Asperger's and bullying is some information that you shared with me when I asked you questions for the Autism Life Skills book. I think it was from you saying that sometimes some of the bullying is not perceived as bullying or indirect bullying from teachers. For example, teachers making remarks to a student with Asperger's. They may not realize the person has Asperger's, but they don't get it because the student doesn't seem to be following what everyone else is doing. And so then that's a type of bullying coming from a teacher that then just kind of eggs on the other students to bully as well. Is that true?
Absolutely. I think that I don't want to give the impression that I think all teachers are bad, because certainly I think most teachers who go into the profession have their heart in the right place. But I think there are teachers who just don't get it when it comes to the effect that their words have on our population. And the fact that the sarcasm that other students would easily pick up on, it just isn't understood by our population. So it can come across as bullying. And then there are the examples of specific teacher bullying, which is done on purpose. I mean, there was one instance, I think last year, where some teacher in Florida, I don't know if you heard about this, Chantel, but some teacher in Florida actually had the class vote out that student.
Right.
Because I don't know what the reason was, but apparently he was being bad. But this is a kindergartner, and this teacher had the class vote him out of the room, and not only that, but she had the whole class tell this one child one thing that they didn't like about him. Now, that, to me, if that isn't abuse, I don't know what is. So I really think that teacher bullying can be just as damaging, if not more so, than peer bullying, because it's coming from somebody who's supposed to be acting as a protector, somebody who is sanctioned to teach, And somebody's supposed to have the trust of all the students, and that really, really can leave damaging scars on individuals. So I can't stress how important that is.
Correct, and they're also supposed to be setting an example.
Exactly.
Yeah, I remember that story, and it really shocked me, because even if the teacher thought that she was giving some kind of example of a civic class, you know, and like voting about something, it totally was the wrong topic to be doing it on.
Absolutely, and there are so many other ways to handle that sort of situation, and especially we're talking about somebody who is in kindergarten, who developmentally is not going to understand everything that's going on, but is going to internalize it as, I am bad. And that's what happened. He went home that day, and he said to his mom, I am not special. I am not special, over and over again. And I'm sure that that episode is going to leave lasting scars on him. And, you know, just a few weeks ago, I found out that this teacher was reinstated, which absolutely infuriated me. I really don't see any justification for letting this woman back into the classroom. But apparently there were enough supporters on her behalf that got her back into the school system.
Well, I didn't know that. That is infuriating. Before we continue, I would like to, we're going to be continuing all the way through, but I wanted to actually address a question from one of our listeners, and that's Ernest in Irvine, who's asking if you could tell us a little bit about Asperger's.
Sure. Asperger's is a part of the autism spectrum. It's considered a high-functioning form of autism. There are some people who will debate that. Tony Atwood, who's the leading expert on Asperger's, I think pretty much sets the tone when he says that it is a high-functioning form of autism. And basically, the way I would personally define it is that people with Asperger's, and I'm going to speak in first person here since I have Asperger's, we have a different way of viewing the world, again, from emotional, sensory, and cultural viewpoints, so that we take in the world pretty literally. Our senses are exacerbated to the point where we can be very hypersensitive to stimuli, or we can be undersensitive, hyposensitive to stimuli. We also have difficulty with friendship. Not that we can't be friends with people. You know, I think you'll hear that people with Asperger's can be the best friends in the whole world, but friendship doesn't come as easily to us as it does to the majority of people, just because we have trouble with nonverbal cues. We have trouble understanding sarcasm. We have trouble basically negotiating our way through the social terrain that neurotypicals take for granted. An example would be if you were thinking about somebody riding a bike. It's pretty intuitive if you've ridden a bike enough times to know what to do as far as pushing the pedals. But if you think about socializing like riding a bike, it would be like somebody with Asperger's getting on a bike and actually having to think about what to do to make the pedals move forward. And that would be a pretty time-consuming process, and it would take a lot of energy out of you to do that on a daily basis, day in and day out. So I think it can best be defined as a different way of relating to the world, basically, which can make life a little bit more challenging than it is for most folks. That's sort of my abbreviated definition. There are obviously other things that I can say, and I'm sure those things will come up as we go along.
When I'm speaking at a conference on adolescent issues, and I try to explain to educators and parents about the social aspect, you know, putting aside the sensory for a moment, and I try and explain the things that we need to help our young people with Asperger's learn about the social cues, I suggest to think about if you were landing in a different country. Like, for example, we're Americans, so we speak English, but if we were in England, they have cultural social habits that are different than ours. And so if we landed over there, we'd still be acting like Americans, and we wouldn't have the same cues, and we wouldn't understand some of the habits that they have. And so you think about the things that you take for granted and explain to somebody how they would tell a foreigner who was landing there how to act in a certain situation. Does that kind of describe a little bit?
Absolutely. That's the best definition I could use, and I actually have used that definition when I've spoken at conferences. Yeah, I mean, it's absolutely true. It's like landing in a foreign country where you don't know the language, or maybe you know a little bit of the language, and really learning every day how to be a part of that culture. And here, you know, people with Asperger's are part of the culture every single day. So they sort of have this guilt enforced internally, which says, you know, you've been in this culture so long, why don't you get it? You know, at least if you go to England or China or someplace you haven't gone to, there's a bit of an understanding that you've never been there before. But here, it's kind of like you've lived here for so long, why aren't you getting it? And I think the fact that Asperger's is becoming much more understood is definitely a positive sign. And the fact that movies like Adam are opening pretty soon will help those with Asperger's kind of integrate a little bit more successfully than would otherwise be the case. But up until now, it has not been easy for us. That's definitely true.
Right. But the good thing is that it is moving positively forward. So, and thanks to information that people like you are providing. So should we start with some questions here?
Sure, why not?
Okay. Here's a question from Debbie Small in Kansas City. I have a 5-year-old with autism Asperger's. I would like to know how to lay a good foundation with friends, teachers, neighbors, and the church to minimize bullying. Please let me know what I can do to be proactive. Thank you. So she's trying to ask what she can do, in other words, to prepare so that there will minimize the risk of having bullying.
Well, I think becoming as active in your community as possible is really, really important. And the more people understand those with Asperger's, I truly believe that the more tolerance and acceptance there will be. So I think that you have to be very proactive in your community. And if you're not comfortable with disclosure, I think that's something that you should become comfortable with, because I think that I think all the people in your community will benefit from your example and from your son's, from understanding your son. And the more of us understand the Asperger's experience, there will be a kind of a domino effect, in my opinion. So to lay a good foundation, I think you really need to be active in the school system, very in touch with your child's teacher, and the principal, and it sounds like you already are, so just kind of keep doing what you're doing.
Yeah, now let's talk a little bit about disclosure, because I find that to be a hot topic generally with parents. Many parents who have children with Asperger's or adolescents think that, oh, they don't want to mention the word because their kid's doing okay. Now, how do you feel about that?
You know, I think it really depends on the individual situation. As a general rule of thumb, though, I am in favor of disclosure. It's real easy for me to say as an adult. I mean, you know, had I been a child of 10 or 11 years old, I'm not so sure I would have been as enthusiastic about it as I'm sounding in retrospect. But on the other hand, I really think that it depends on how it's presented to the student and to other people. I mean, there's a balanced approach to disclosing Asperger's. On the one hand, I've heard of parents who focus on nothing but the negatives. And of course, if you focus on only the negatives, the child's going to internalize it negatively. I mean, that just makes sense. And so will the other classmates. And then if you only focus on the positives, and there are a lot of positives to having Asperger's, such as the sense of justice that we possess. You know, we have a strong sense of right and wrong, and we like to see justice prevail. You often hear about people with Asperger's being little policemen on the playground because they don't want to see somebody get away with a wrongdoing. So there are many, many positives that you can stress. You know, the fact that we think that Albert Einstein had Asperger's, Thomas Jefferson, there have been books written about these people. But if you only stress the positives, then what you can sometimes create is the child who not only has Asperger's, but has prima donna syndrome and thinks that his Asperger's makes him better than everyone else. So I think that you really need a balanced approach when you disclose this to your child and if you take the option of disclosing it to the rest of the class. Now, when should you do it? I personally think it's when the child views themselves as being different. And that's going to happen inevitably no matter who your child is. Because if you have Asperger's, you are different. I mean, that's just kind of part of the definition of having Asperger's. So I think that when that happens and when you can sense that your child is struggling internally because of this, Maybe an explanation, a balanced explanation, will sort of ease their worries, and it'll be a weight lifted off their back, and they'll say, oh, my God, so this is what's going on. I mean, that's how I reacted at age 27, and I certainly wish that I would have gotten my diagnosis a lot earlier in life, because it would have explained so much about what happened to me that I had previously no understanding of.
Yeah, Michael John Carley, who's the head of GRASP, who has also written forward to your books, I think, or at least to the Asperger Syndrome and Bullying book, he actually says that he believes in disclosure because he says that people with Asperger's grow up knowing there's different. They feel different. And so in this way, they can put a name on it, and then they can find the practical strategies to help them in the areas in which they may have difficulties.
Exactly. And once you have that piece of information, then you can really capitalize on your strengths, knowing kind of your neuropsychological, neurobiological roadmap, so to speak. So if I know, for example, that I'm not good at multitasking, and I know that that's a symptom of Asperger's, I'm going to avoid situations that involve multitasking. And before I got my diagnosis at age 27, just because I didn't know any better, I used to put myself in job settings where I would have to multitask, and not surprisingly, it would go disastrously. So now that I've gotten diagnosed, it's not that I avoid things more, it's just that I strategically place myself in settings where I'm able to succeed. And I think that's really the main benefit. I mean, aside from self-acceptance, I think that putting yourself in situations where you can succeed are the two main benefits of disclosure and knowing about one's Asperger's.
Mm-hmm. Right. Here's a question. Somebody wants to know, Denise Young in Tustin, are you aware of any informational classes for kids about kids with Asperger's and other challenges given by school counselors, psychologists, or teachers? Do you know people who go in and give information to classrooms of kids about Asperger's?
Well, I mean, I don't specifically, but my understanding would be that a lot of us advocates, I mean, I know that I myself go into a lot of school districts, and I talk to either the school faculty or I talk to sometimes groups of children just to kind of explain what Asperger's is and kind of demystify it. So I would imagine, and I've talked to a lot of advocates, self-advocates, and they do that sort of thing too. So I don't know of anyone specifically, but, I mean, I would think that it wouldn't be that difficult to arrange.
You know, I would suggest to this person that they contact a local chapter of their Autism Society of America, because I know that a lot of local chapters have people with Asperger's as members, and some of those individuals like to go out and do informational training or sharing of to help the peers be more accepting of the other students. Also, if there are chapters of GRASP, you can go online to GRASP, G-R-A-S-P, and I know that in certain areas there are support groups. Now, I'm not sure that all of them are people who want to go out and have the time to do trainings, but some of them may. So that's a good option, I think, to look into.
Absolutely. Go ahead.
Okay, sorry. Here's a question from Poway. What recommendations do you have for working with the elementary schools that ignore bullying or allow bullying?
I think that's a really good question, and I think that it depends on the state that you live in. Some states are actually pushing for laws which would make it mandatory that these school districts implement bullying prevention programs so that it would have to be taken seriously. There are some states on the book that don't have any laws, and unfortunately in those states, a parent's recourse is not as great as it would be if it was mandatory. But I think you just have to become really, really outspoken at your school and, kind of be a pain in the neck to the teacher without being rude. And obviously you want to recognize that they have a busy job. But at the same time, this is your child who you're sending off 6 hours a day. So it's kind of like their second home. And I think you have a right as a parent to make sure that your child is being protected while at school. And if they're not doing their job, then you can go even higher. You can go to the principal, the superintendent, and even the city board if necessary. But I think that being proactive and getting a bunch of other parents to be proactive as well so that your voices are being heard in the community is extremely important, and that's what always makes a difference. People, groups of people coming together to support a common cause.
Well, that brought up a good question. I mean, you mentioned laws, but Vicki in Lottsville asks, is there not a federal law now being enacted to prevent bullying of any kind in schools?
My understanding is that there isn't a federal law. I'm pretty sure that it goes on a state-by-state basis, and I know that the majority of states have such a law in place. The only states that don't right now are Alabama, the District of Columbia, Hawaii, Massachusetts, Michigan, Mississippi, Montana, North Carolina, North Dakota, South Dakota, Wisconsin, and Wyoming. So if you don't live in one of those states, there should be a law on the book that clearly defines what bullying is, clearly spells out what needs to happen when it takes place, clearly talks about what kind of bullying prevention program should be in place. If you live in one of the states that I mentioned that doesn't have such a law on the books, then what you need to do is become very active at the grassroots level and organize meetings for the House for a House subcommittee and just make your voice heard. And the way that these bills have passed through other states is it started with parents. Parents got fed up with the fact that their schools were ignoring their children. They banded together, and now the majority of states have these laws in the book. So it's really, really, I can't stress enough how important it is for parents to be proactive.
Yeah, I totally agree. Here's an interesting question from Jen Caledone in Ontario. At what point does bullying become abuse and need to be addressed within the legal system? When does bullying become abuse? That's an interesting question.
Well, bullying by definition is a power imbalance. But when it becomes an abuse, in my opinion, is when there's a threat of intimidation, when somebody's safety is in jeopardy. And that's, I'm not just talking about physical safety. I'm talking about emotional safety, too.
Uh-huh.
See, a lot of these issues are so complicated. For example, cyberbullying. Now, in my opinion, cyberbullying is wrong. And just to tell you what cyberbullying is, basically it's bullying over the Internet. So it could be saying something on Facebook about someone, you know, very, very derogatory comments, putting them up on MySpace, creating fake websites, things like that. And unfortunately, school systems have their hands tied because they say it happens off school hours, and that's true. But a lot of parents are banding together and saying, now, wait a minute, what happens outside of school affects what happens during the school hours, and if a child can't even feel safe in his home, he's probably not going to feel safe in the classroom as well. So I think that, you know, there's so many issues and so many legalities that need to be worked through. And bullying is defined differently pretty much everywhere you go. In every state, there's kind of a different definition. Even though it's similar, the wording is different. So you really have to find out in Ontario, since I'm not familiar with how they define it there, you really have to find out how they define it and then kind of go from there.
Here's Margot from Syracuse. She wants to know, is it common for Asperger's syndrome boys who are frequently bullied to then show bullying behavior towards younger or weaker kids?
I don't know if I want to say it's common, but I definitely have heard of it happening. You know, a lot of times people with Asperger's can bully others almost inadvertently because they want to be in control of a situation. So if the situation escalates to something beyond their control, they may exhibit bullying-like behavior. Okay, for example, let's say that Mark, who has Asperger's, is placed in a group of children to do math work. Okay, now number one, Mark is much better than everyone else at math, and number two, it's a group setting. So he's uncomfortable with both aspects of that situation. So he's going to say, Mrs. Jones, I'm so much better at them than math. I don't want to be put with them. Now that kind of remark can come across as being bullying-like because it's belligerent, but what really is missing is that there's not a power imbalance between Mark and the other children. And as a matter of fact, the other children have the power imbalance over Mark. So that can set someone up for being a provocative bullier or a provocative victim, I should say, because the bullying that they display kind of turns them into a victim. And the other thing is that, yes, if somebody is bullied over and over again for a year or two, eventually there's going to, in my opinion, be some sort of retaliation at some point. Not in every case, but for a lot of kids with Asperger's, if they feel that they have no other recourse, sometimes there's a straw that breaks the camel's back, and it's not a pretty sight. I know a lot of parents who have tried to put in the IEP, the fact that if there is a retaliation, and it's clear that it's a retaliation, that the child shouldn't be punished. So, yes, I do believe that sometimes people with Asperger's can display bullying-like behavior, but I don't always think that it is true bullying if you look beyond the surface aspects of the situation.
Right. And Temple Grandin always talks about how when she was in school, she was constantly getting called tape recorder and teased by her peers. And one day she just got fed up and threw a book. Now, that got her kicked out of school because she threw a book and hit somebody. But it was all this time of people name-calling her that got her to that point. But she was the one who got in trouble because back then they didn't have any understanding about that. And, in fact, right now they still don't in many areas, but it is starting to change in a positive way. At least that's what I've been hearing. Have you been hearing the same, Nick?
I do think it's changing, but I want to go back to your point about what you mentioned about Temple, and that is, you know, most bullying does not take place in front of the presence of authority. So
right.
All this bullying, all this escalation that's building up, teachers don't see that. What they see is the one big incident, and that usually is the retaliatory incident. So what happens is the victim is the one who gets blamed, you know, the whole blame the victim syndrome.
Right.
And so they're the ones who get punished. And unfortunately, we need to change that. We need to stop it before it gets to that point. And that's sort of been my mission over the past 2-3 years is to teach educators the behaviors that trigger the bullying, not that somebody with Asperger's ever deserves to be bullied, but the fact is that they do display certain behaviors that's going to naturally trigger bullying from their peers. So I definitely think that teachers have to be much more proactive as far as keeping an eye on what's going on outside of the classroom, in the cafeteria, in the playground, even sometimes in the bathroom bullying can take place, on the school bus. These are areas where there's not a lot of supervision. So that's where teachers really have to step it up.
Do you feel that by teaching what's called hidden curriculum to the students with Asperger's, that would be helpful in or a proactive way of minimizing bullying?
Yeah, I think so. I think learning the hidden rules that most people intuitively grasp would definitely help. I mean, the fact that most people know that in middle school you're not supposed to wear Velcro shoes. I mean, who teaches you that kind of stuff? But yet most people intuitively pick it up, whereas somebody with Asperger's doesn't pick it up. You know, we don't understand the fact that we're supposed to be a certain distance away from somebody else in the boys' bathroom, or, you know, and all these hidden rules that we don't know, you know, that we're not taught and you don't read in a textbook. So, yeah, absolutely. What Brenda Miles has done as far as the hidden curriculum, to me, has been invaluable to the ASD community.
Actually, she's just put out now, you know, she had put out a hidden curriculum calendar, and now there's a new hidden curriculum calendar for older kids, actually adolescents and young adults.
Oh, really?
So it teaches, yeah, it just came out. I just received the review copy, so that might be something you want to look out for. It's for a 2010 calendar, and so whereas the hidden curriculum originally addressed, the first calendar she put out addressed, you know, the younger kids or things that people in elementary school should know, she now has a calendar which is for the adolescent and young adults.
I think that's wonderful, and I think that I've been really outspoken in the last couple of years that there needs to be more material for the older population because that's when the bullying really escalates in middle school and high school. So I think that's great.
And, you know, I might be off the mark here, but I actually recommend to parents, even if their kids have autism but do not technically have Asperger's, that they use those. I mean, my son is nonverbal, so he's not technically Asperger's, but he understands quite a bit. He still needs to know what appropriate behaviors are, and I don't think he knows those things through osmosis either. So I always tell people you can look a lot at the Asperger's curriculum and work it out to use for anybody on the spectrum, actually.
I agree. I mean, like you said, he has receptive language abilities, and he observes the world around him, even if he can't properly express every moment how he feels. So it's not like he can't learn that material.
Right. Okay, so now we have a nice question from Marissa in South San Francisco. And I do apologize if I'm destroying people's names, especially with the name that I have. I'm very sensitive to it, but so please excuse me if I mispronounce your names. So here's the question. When approaching teachers and the principal with concerns of kids with special needs who are being bullied, it does not seem to fix the bullying problem. It stops for a day or two, but then it goes back to the same as if I had never approached the teacher or the principal. My situation is a child with mild autism, a lot of social problems. I've spoken with other parents as to how they handle this kind of situation, and they've gone up to all different levels, such as the superintendent and the mayor, you name it. They receive no answer to the concern of our kids.
Well, my suggestion would be, and I have this right in front of me, California is fortunately one of the states where there are laws in place where apparently there have to be mandatory bullying prevention programs, and authorities such as teachers and principals are mandated to do something about it when this happens. So I would go and I would do a little bit of research, and I would see what laws are on the books, how you can utilize those laws, because maybe you weren't even aware that these laws in your state existed. So I would really become proactive in learning what repercussions or what resources you have as a parent to make sure that these people are doing their job.
Yeah, and I would say that the reason why it stops for a day or two is because they've probably just addressed the little symptom, but they haven't put an overall plan as to how they're going to address bullying for the whole school. And isn't bullying a whole school problem and not just one person problem?
Absolutely. It starts from the top down, and I think that having uniformity in all the classrooms is so important. Some people will say, well, you know, but you're teaching kindergartners something that you know, kindergartners are so cognitively different than fifth graders, so how can you keep it consistent? You have very simple rules that every single person in the school can understand.
Right.
And when you have it from a whole school perspective, then everybody is on the same page. You know, there are instances where in first grade, the rules in the classroom are completely different than they would be the next year with a different second grade teacher. So I think that it is important. And, you know, I kind of compare it to being in a city, for example, and let's say that every block there was a different set of laws that you had to follow. It would become very confusing for adults. Well, that's the same for children. Children need uniformity. They need to know what is acceptable in the whole building, what is tolerated, what isn't tolerated. And I think that a whole school approach really solves that problem. It does take some motivation on the part of principals to kind of create something, and that maybe can come from, you know, the school district. They can have something in place, but it really needs to come from the top down, in my opinion.
Well, I just find it kind of extraordinary that it is such an issue in schools that they don't recognize this, because what we're talking about here is respect.
Mm-hmm.
And aren't they supposed to be teaching respect at school? You respect your teacher and you respect your classmates. And so if you follow that basic law, then anything that's not respectful towards another person should be something that's considered inappropriate behavior.
Absolutely. And, one reason why I think this isn't happening, to be quite honest with you, is the fact that there's so much emphasis placed on these academic tests. You know, I've talked to so many teachers at these conferences that I've spoken at, and they say to me, "Well, I would address it if I could, but I'm so under the gun as far as teaching to the test, and our schools and our districts won't get funding if these kids don't perform. So I'm really spending all of my time making sure that I'm teaching them the core base, you know, for No Child Left Behind." And what that really ignores is, among other things, the fact that there are more things important than state capitals. Somebody who goes to school and doesn't feel like they're being respected and feels like they're not safe, to me that takes priority over somebody learning about state capitals. I think the fundamental basis of somebody attending school should be that they're in a safe environment where learning can occur, because learning won't occur unless somebody feels safe. I mean, if you look at Abraham Maslow's hierarchy of needs, safety is at the bottom. So unless you feel safe in the environment that you're in, you're not going to learn. So people should really recognize that, in my opinion.
Right, and that these are life skills, and that's basically life skills that people need to learn. And so if they're not being learned by the students at school and as well at home, where are they supposed to be learning these life skills?
Exactly. They're not going to pick it up without direct instruction, in my opinion, and especially because the peer influence is so strong. You almost sort of need to unlearn these destructive trends. You know, I think we're all basically born good, but I think that through influence we learn negative habits, and I think it's just a matter of unlearning these habits and kind of getting back to the good, the essence of who we are, which is good, caring individuals. But we need to kind of be reminded of that as children, I think.
Thank you so much for sharing that with us. We're learning so much this evening. There's a person here who's written a very long question. It's actually an adult, and I wondered if, can I go ahead and talk about this man who kind of sends in a little bit of his history?
Okay.
Shall I go ahead? It's Joel from Houston, Texas, but I wanted to warn you that it's the description's a little long, but I think it's interesting so that people realize what can happen to adults with Asperger's if we aren't helping them when they're younger. So here we go. Here's the background. I am a 45-year-old former civil engineer, unemployed now for nearly 2 years, and recently diagnosed with ASD, PDD, Asperger's syndrome. I also have major depression and anxiety that I've been treated for over 10 years. About 2.5 years ago, in the midst of a great deal of workplace bullying, I began to have panic attacks and extreme claustrophobia, and started to have recurring nightmares in which I was audibly yelling and even getting violent with objects in my room while sleeping. These dreams often were involving these workplace bullies or my father. I started to suspect PTSD, and while discussing PTSD with a psychologist, I was diagnosed with PDD and environmental triggers. I should be at the prime of my career right now, but these panic attacks and some very strong negative feelings have totally disabled me. My father was an Army Green Beret in Vietnam. We moved over 25 times before I finished high school. I was in preschool in Berlin, Kansas, and New Mexico, and became very dazed and numb during that time. My father was diagnosed with schizophrenia and also eventually convicted of child abuse. I am the only one in my family to ever go to college, and now all my family thinks I'm just being lazy. I'm withdrawing from all relationships now for nearly a year because of the depression. I have also read Elaine Aaron's book about HSP, which is highly sensitive persons, and find it is a very good description of my situation. My question, can treatment get me over these panic attacks and away from depending on Xanax? And can treatment help me to relearn how to genuinely connect with people? I have become more and more isolated to the point that my only real connections are with animals. And lastly, is there any correlation with Asperger's and PTSD or so-called complex PTSD? I have to go to an SSA disability hearing soon, and I don't know what I can legally and medically justify. So the first question is, can treatment get me over these panic attacks and away from depending on Xanax? And can treatment help me to relearn how to genuinely reconnect with people?
Joel, I definitely think so. Obviously, I'm very sorry to hear about all the things that you've gone through over the years, and I've heard of similar situations to the situation that you describe, but I absolutely think that we can learn how to control our anxiety and control our reactions to things. And one of the best treatments that I recommend is actually cognitive behavioral therapy. I've actually been in CBT for the last 2 or 3 years, and it's worked wonders for me, Joel, let me tell you. I mean, I was probably the most anxious person on the planet. I always was thinking ahead, will something happen? I think I had pretty much a good case of OCD, and the CBT helped me to kind of slow down, monitor my thoughts, monitor what was going on in my head, and think about what was accurate and what was fantasy. And distinguishing between what's accurate and what's fantasy is invaluable, because then you can kind of live life as if you are a part of it, rather than just living within your head, which takes a lot of energy out of you. It would take a lot of energy out of everyone. The other thing that I would suggest, Joel, is I really think that it's important, if you haven't already, to connect with people on the spectrum. I wasn't sure in your question if you had alluded to that, but I think that it's so important once we find out that we have an Asperger diagnosis to meet others on the spectrum. I know Michael John stresses this a lot too, because we kind of see that we weren't alone through the process, that there were other people who were going through similar circumstances and reacting similarly. There were other people who were having meltdowns when we were having meltdowns. There were others who had issues relating to having problems with transitions or employment or whatever. So I think kind of that camaraderie that you can build with other human beings, and I think it's wonderful that you have a connection with animals. I know that a lot of individuals on the spectrum really, really connect with animals. But I also think that if you can connect with people too, it would really give you more of a sense of strength, and you could find your strength in others rather than just within yourself. And I think when others can help to give you that strength, especially people who you have something in common with, I really think that that's going to benefit you, Joel.
Before I move on to the other question, because that's really good advice, would it be correct that I suggest, or we suggest to Joel, to look online for GRASP for resources of other people on the spectrum that he can connect with? Or
absolutely.
Do you have other resources?
I know that there's some sort of Asperger group that I'm going to be speaking at in Houston in December. I think it's the ASCII something or other of Houston. It could easily be looked up on Google. But Joel, you could probably come and see me. I'm going to be there in early December. But, yes, absolutely. I don't know if GRASP has a chapter in Houston, but even connecting online and looking at the positive influence that certain members of GRASP have had on the ASD community, I think that in and of itself can be very therapeutic.
Okay, and finding a cognitive behavioral therapist in your area is kind of the same. You try and find other people who have used one who they would recommend.
Absolutely, and I think, Joel, it's really important that you make sure that the person has a little bit of familiarity with autism spectrum disorders. I've seen therapists who had no clue about Asperger's or autism, and they tried treating me with a cookie-cutter approach. I mean, they basically tried treating me as if I was, you know, Joe Schmo off the street, and that doesn't work. You really need an individualized approach, and that can only come about when they understand what Asperger's is and how it manifests in you. So if the therapist says, you know what, I'm really busy, I see 12 clients a day, then, you know, you can say, fine, it seems like you're doing enough business, you don't need mine. So you really want to see somebody who has expertise in Asperger's, and at the very least, if they don't, that they'd be willing to learn a little bit more about it.
Okay. And the next, last part of his question, is there any correlation between Asperger's and PTSD, or so-called complex PTSD? And he's asking this because he has to go to a SSA disability hearing soon, and I don't know what I can legally and medically justify.
My understanding is that there is a correlation between Asperger's and PTSD. I don't know the exact percentages, but if you think about it, it makes sense. I mean, even from the realm of bullying, we get bullied more often than most people. So that's going to manifest later on as PTSD. I mean, for example, when I go out and I deal with other people, sometimes my interactions are a bit strained, because if I run into somebody who reminds me of a former bully, that kind of triggers a PTSD-like reaction in me. At the moment, it's kind of unexplained, but then later on I reflect upon it and I say, wait a minute, this person really reminded me of somebody who bullied me. So that kind of thing. Parents who didn't understand us, teachers who kind of belittled us for causing trouble. I mean, the environmental circumstances are in place to create situations that are very, very harmful to our well-being and can easily cause us to feel bad about ourselves. Not to mention that I've seen statistics that say that people with autism are at a greater likelihood to be abused sexually, unfortunately. So, yes, I do believe that there is a correlation between the two.
Very good. Gosh, Nick, you're really a wealth of information.
Thank you.
Oh, seriously. Okay, so here's Annette from San Diego. Would you recommend play acting bullying at home as a way for our kids to think about what they would do? If so, can you give an example that would be appropriate? I guess it's like play role.
You know, one thing that you could do, and I'm assuming this person is asking this as far as how to react towards people who are bullying that child, does it say?
Correct. Right.
I think
like how would they react if they get bullied?
Yeah. I think that coming up with assertive scripts, and I know that Rebecca Heinrich sometimes talks about this, things like, hey, pal, watch it, or back off, something that somebody can memorize. Can really do wonders. I mean, you want to keep it as generic as possible so you're not insulting the person, especially if the person is 2 feet taller than your child. But the child, a child who stands up for himself is less likely to be picked on than the child who overreacts to something and goes crazy or just kind of shrivels up in his shell. I think somebody who's assertive but not aggressive is going to keep the bullies at bay. The other thing is I think that sometimes doing role plays can help where you and your child role play what the bully might say, and then you come up with things that you can say to the, you know, the parent is playing the part of the bully and the child is being himself, and you role play it so that the child can say, well, what would Timmy say in this circumstance? And the child would say that, and then you kind of play it out. And I think another thing that can help is looking off of the TV for shows that the child likes, you know, because we know that kids with ASD sometimes can watch a movie and have that movie memorized within two or three times of viewing it. So I think that using characters on TV, while the situations are dramatized and they're not totally real, they can sort of give a sense of what would Superman do in this situation? You know, I mean, kind of vicariously putting your child in the place of a character on TV is kind of similar to comic strip conversations where you're putting yourself in the place of a character that you're creating on paper. So I think those are a few things.
Very good. I have to say, I'm going to read a question now, but when I read some of these questions, it just I find it very upsetting that people have to go through this every day, that kids have to go through this every day. It's really heart-wrenching because I don't see how parents can really feel comfortable. It's so hard for a parent knowing that they're sending their child to school not fully prepared and you don't know what kind of environment they're going to be in. But here is a question from Carrie in Saginaw.
Mm-hmm.
Hi, Nick. My son is high-functioning Asperger's. He has been the center of a bullying ring, and whenever he has complained about it, the principal says he is lying or talks him right into believing he is lying so he changes his story. Well, I caught the bullying firsthand myself, and I wasn't too happy. It happened to be just the last day of school last year, and of course the principal wasn't in. So my question to you is, how do I approach this at the beginning of school this coming year and stay professional when the principal is always coming up with excuses because he is not going to allow it to continue? My son is only in third grade, and when he enters school, he totally shuts down. He loves to learn, and I want to know he is safe when he goes to school.
What I would say is, first of all, you live in Saginaw, which is not too far away from where I live, and I would be very happy to do a presentation at your school to kind of shed some light on this issue. But I think that what you need to do is you need to go higher up than the principal. If the principal is blowing you off or not giving you what you need or, worse, making it worse, then you go up the chain of command. And if worse comes to worse, I know of parents who have taken their kids out of a particular school, placed them in a school maybe a little bit farther away, but with a more understanding principal or teacher or whatever. So I think that sometimes drastic action has to be taken. And if you're not getting what you need, and you need to be getting what you need because, this is your child's safety, then you have to do whatever you need to do to sort of rectify the situation.
I also would want to comment to parents, because sometimes it's painful to do this, but I would say document everything. You should have a little notebook that you are writing every single little tiny thing down. And I would hope that, for example, in this case, the parent was able to write down what happened and at least send a letter to the principal, because I just know from having filed due process twice, nothing to do with bullying, but still my unsafe situations or negligent behavior or situations that my son was not safe, but not due to bullying from students. And the thing is that if you document every single little thing, you know, you're basing it on fact, not on emotion. And also the school district can't possibly have had the time to document everything because they don't even know what's going on. So here you have everything documented, and it's a good factual basis to start off from. And it's really necessary in these emotional issues to also have these facts to back it up.
Absolutely. I couldn't agree more.
Okay, here's from Nancy Bradley in Cape May. My son does not like school due to difficult transitions from one elementary school to another within the district, the move to a different school every 3 years, for example. He tends to become overwhelmed and melts down. He becomes nonverbal, runs away, yells, hides in closets. Because he is high-functioning most of the time, most children did not notice this behavior at a younger age. Now what friends he have no longer want to be friends and make it known to him as well as his siblings, they don't like him. Boy, this happens a lot when kids get older, doesn't it? It has become school-wide to the point I have to keep him home from school several days. How do I make a sad face smile again? Should I make a request to the school to have social training for the kids in general classes, or is that too much?
Well, I think there needs to be a plan in place when the child is about to have a meltdown. First of all, you teach the child to recognize that there is a buildup. I mean, whenever a volcano explodes, it doesn't just explode out of thin air. There's always a buildup. So you teach the child to recognize those signs. And then I think every school should have like a room dedicated to when the child is about to have that meltdown, they can politely excuse themselves and go to that room, because it makes them look very, very different if they're going to have that meltdown in public. If they're able to excuse themselves, go to the room, let out all the steam that they need to let out, and then return maybe 15, 20 minutes later while they are leaving the classroom, and that might create, you know, some stares, it is better than actually having that meltdown in the classroom where everybody can view it. So, you know, I mean, Chantel, I kind of compare it to throwing up. I mean, that's a gross analogy, but when you throw up, you don't just do it in front of everyone else. You get the warning signs, and then as soon as you know it's about to happen, I don't care if you're in a play, an airplane, wherever, you're going to do everything you can to not do it in front of others, not because it's wrong per se, but because, you know, it's better to do something like that in private. So I think that schools really need to kind of create a chill room, C-H-I-L-L, or some sort of safety room where kids can go, not abusing the privilege, of course, but a room where they know they can go to have those meltdowns if need be.
I think that's a very good analogy that you made. And what about what Nancy says about making a request to the school to have social training for the kids in general classes?
As far as how to respond to that one child, is that what you think she means?
Should I make a request to the school to have social training for the kids in general classes, or is that too much? I'm not quite sure what she means, but I was thinking more in terms of I think peer training, or not even training, but just like an informational thing about what is Asperger's, but, you know, in a positive way, and how some people who have Asperger's may react. So, for example, when my son is mainstreamed, he can't speak, but he can write on his light writer or on his talking PowerPoint. He prepares it before the start of the school year, and then he gets permission from the teachers, and he gives a five-minute spiel. His machinery speaks for him, and it's all about how, you know, he may look like he's not listening and he can't get his body to move, so sometimes he has to get up and leave because he doesn't have control over his body. So people don't think, why is he acting so weird all the time? Or, you know, for someone with Asperger's, it might be different, but a lot of times kids are afraid of what they don't understand. So if kids don't know anything about what it is like when you have Asperger's, or why someone does become nonverbal because they're stressed out, then sometimes if they know about this, then it's easier for them to accept a person. I don't know if that makes sense what I'm saying.
Oh, absolutely. I think that that does make sense. And I think the other thing is peer mentoring, I think, is hugely successful when it comes eliminating the bullying. I mean, we have a program here in Michigan called the LINCS program where individuals who are in special education, it could be an Asperger individual, somebody who's learning disabled, somebody who's emotionally impaired, are placed with a LINC, which is really a mentor, and that person kind of shows them the ropes, integrates them into the mainstream setting. So, you know, the typical ASD child is going to sit alone at lunch, and we know that kids who are isolated are the ones who are most likely to be bullied. So with the LINC says, hey, come on, sit over here. And then if anybody gives that kid a hard time, the LINC is there to kind of say, wait a minute, what are you doing? Knock it off. So peer mentoring, I think, is really, really effective. And the school systems that I've gone to pretty much say that it solves the problem. I mean, I don't want to make it too simplistic, but when you integrate that kid into the social setting so that he's no longer by himself and he's with a group of people who understand him, and remember, these people are taking classes for credit, so they're learning about Asperger's and they're learning about autism and they're learning about how to react when the kid has a meltdown. It really can be almost a life-saving tool, in my opinion.
Great. Here's a question from Bala Subramanian in India. What is psychotherapy for Asperger's syndrome? And what does a therapist do in a therapy session?
You know, I don't think there's been a certain kind of therapy that's been created specifically for somebody with Asperger's. And I'm talking about adults. For children, obviously, there's, if we're talking about young children, there are different kinds of therapy like ABA, floor time. What I'm really looking to see happen in the future is therapists becoming more aware of the adult population as far as people with AS seeking adult therapy because, you know, really there is not a lot of awareness when it comes to psychotherapists treating our population. So I really believe that CBT, as I mentioned before, is
Do you mind describing to people what cognitive behavioral therapy is?
Sure, absolutely. Cognitive behavioral therapy is basically looking at your thought processes and making sure that your thoughts accurately match up with reality. So typically in a CBT session, the therapist will challenge you to rethink about some of your assumptions. Sometimes, you know, with the black and white thinking that people with Asperger's tend to display, and we can get so caught up in our black and white thinking that we need an objective voice who isn't our parent, who isn't somebody who's in the thick of it with us, somebody who's kind of on the sideline saying, now, wait a minute, have you thought about rethinking this? The other strength about CBT, cognitive behavioral therapy, is that it plays to a person's logic, right? And we know that people with Asperger's are very logical. So if we get them to look at situations in a more logical way, kind of not their logic, but the logic of what's really going on, it tends to be really successful. There's a book that I would recommend by Valerie Goss, G-A-U-S, and it's a book about cognitive behavioral therapy with adult Asperger syndrome patients. And I recommend that pretty much to every therapist who I meet who is looking to work more with our population.
Great. Thank you so much for explaining that. Here's a question from Christina in Pittsburgh. As a teacher's aide, what are some strategies or strategies and or techniques I can put in place when one of my students is being bullied? We have no bullying policy in our school district. However, I am wondering how I can empower my students and make them understand.
Okay. I think that, and I don't know if I've talked about this previously tonight, but I think that peer intervention when somebody is being bullied is the utmost important piece of any bullying prevention program. So in other words, bystanders really need to get involved when they see one of their peers being victimized. Unfortunately, that doesn't happen very often because most people don't want to associate themselves with the victim because then they would be seen as being the victim's friend. So it's really a political thing that's going on the playground. And I think that any bullying prevention program, any whole school approach should focus primarily on what to do when they see somebody being victimized. That it's not only the right thing to do to tell the teacher, but it's the right thing to actually confront the bully head on. So when you have a group of students who come together and say, hey, wait a minute, this isn't cool, knock it off, then what you're really doing is you're taking away the incentive to bully, because most people bully to become popular. And if you're taking away the incentive of popularity, then you're really handcuffing the bully and saying, wait a minute, this isn't going to work. So the whole mindset, I think, at a school needs to be changed, and that's what I would recommend. And I know there are bullying prevention programs in place that mention, or I should say emphasize, bystander support, but any successful bullying prevention program will have that piece.
Great. That's good information. Connie from Rockford just asked, what is PTSD? So I think it's post-traumatic stress disorder, but how does that relate to, for example, Asperger's syndrome?
Well, PTSD is a reaction. It's most associated with wartime veterans coming home where they've seen some pretty bloody scenes in battle and react back home as if they're living through the battle again. And as I said earlier, I think that a lot of us with Asperger's live through some pretty horrific situations growing up, whether, again, we're misunderstood by teachers and constantly ridiculed by them, ostracized from our peers. Maybe we had parents who, you know, really didn't understand what was going on. See, a lot of the people in our generation, I'm in my early 30s, we weren't diagnosed until adulthood. I think the gift that people with Asperger's who are growing up in this generation have is a lot more self-understanding, because the diagnosis is now prevalent. So I predict, actually, that PTSD will go down just because there's a lot more awareness of what Asperger's is and how to best help the child with AS.
Thank you. Here's another adult who's written in, Charles Robson from Johnson City, Tennessee. While I don't remember significant bullying, I do remember many testing how much abuse I would take. I learned to stand my ground possibly due to my objections to injustice. However, when I didn't understand something, e.g. a joke that everyone else seemed to get, there were eye rollings and laughter at my expense. Occasionally, someone would offer an explanation, which was all I wanted, and I would feel relief from the puzzle and then bewilderment from the other's responses. Do I understand correctly that a possible explanation might be my detailed, logical left brain didn't get it, as my right brain didn't offer a big picture, illogical explanation? I am 57 years old and diagnosed at the age of 54.
Well, that definitely is a possibility. I know that many people with AS, particularly those with nonverbal learning disabilities, have what Byron Rourke deems left hemispheric dysfunction, right hemispheric dysfunction, where the left brain is really far superior to the right brain. So we're able to kind of synthesize things. You know, Simon Baron-Cohen talks about the extreme male brain, but we don't get the big picture. And I think that's true for a lot of people with AS. We understand details. We're very detail-oriented. But when it comes to grasping the whole picture, we have some difficulty. So I think that can definitely exacerbate teasing when, for example, we don't understand the nonverbal cues that are taking place, or we don't really understand sarcasm. Those kinds of things go over our heads, and we're missing a lot of what's going on. I mean, 85% of communication that takes place is nonverbal. 15% is verbal, but even with verbal communication, there can be differences in tone and intonation, and you can say one thing one way and mean it totally different if you say it another way. So absolutely, I think that's a plausible explanation.
Good. Vicki from Patton wants to know, how do you explain to a young teenager the difference between mild teasing or joking and being made fun of?
And that is true. I mean, I think that a lot of us with AS have difficulty in sort of deciphering when we are being kind of just joked around with or when it's true bullying. And I think that for those instances, you really need to kind of isolate what happened with your child at school and talk about exactly what situation took place, and then kind of look at it, again, from a cognitive viewpoint. Well, what do you think he meant by that? The other thing is that you really need to teach children to pay attention to the past actions of the person who they're interacting with. So has this person been nice to you before? If so, maybe they truly are a nice person. Have they offered to have you sit at the lunch table? Maybe what they meant, maybe they were just teasing. Typically, if a person is nice for the first time and you've had some dealings with them for, you know, many, many days over the course of a school year, you can pretty much assume that they're laughing at you at your expense. Not always, of course, but the odds are good. If they've never taken the opportunity to be nice to you before and this is the first time they're doing it, there should be sort of a suspicion factor going on, like, hey, what's going on here? And I think kids with AS, because we tend to be gullible sometimes, we don't think about those things. And I think keeping that in mind as far as the past actions of other people can be really important as far as deciphering when somebody's truly bullying us and when it's just teasing or joking.
Thank you. Okay, now here's not a question, but an invitation from Linda Detweiler in Encinitas, which is just a few towns over from me. I'm in lovely San Diego. And she says, we have this very topic on the docket for Parent Info Night slated for Thursday, March 26th. Any chance of you presenting? We're in beautiful San Diego North. Maybe
Absolutely.
We should give her your website so she can contact you.
That would be great. I would love to come to San Diego. I have cousins who live there, and I have a couple of nieces who live there, and it's beautiful. So I would love to present. So please contact me. Yeah, my website is www.aspergerwisdom.com, ASPERGERWISDOM.com. And my email address, which I'm happy to give since it's public information, is Nick Dubin, NickDubin, no space in between Nick and Dubin, at hotmail.com. And, yeah, contact me. I'd love to set something up.
Okay, well, you'll have to let me know if you do come in town.
I sure will.
Okay, here's another question from Annette in San Diego. My son receives ABA therapy at home, and they are getting ready to include bullying with his drills. He's not getting bullied yet, but I'm sure one day he will. What should I be looking for as far as topics and material that they should be covering along with that? Now, I don't know how old my son is, but
yeah,
what
I was kind
of say. I guess I kind of wonder, her question is, what kind of things should you be teaching them now when it's not happening yet? You know, it's kind of proactive.
Right, right. I think that that kind of thing can be taught as far as you know, I don't know if ABA would be the best way that I would recommend because, you know, what I've found with ABA is that it doesn't always generalize. So you can learn – does that make sense, Chantel? You can learn information in one context and in a very strict context with drills, but yet if it's in a different setting and with different people and the tone of voice is different than the person who was doing the drilling, it doesn't always work out well that way. So I'm not sure if I'd really even recommend ABA for the purposes of, I think it has to be in a more spontaneous setting where the person is maybe doing role plays or watching something on TV or creating social stories or even doing comic strip conversations, something where it's a little bit more engaging. I don't mean to be putting down ABA. I just don't think it would be great for this purpose.
Actually, I understand what you're saying, and I know that there's a real problem with the way that ABA therapy is done in a lot of places. And also I know many of the providers in San Diego, and some providers do not at all do generalization. But if ABA is done correctly the way that it was originally meant to be, once something is learned, it is supposed to be generalized. And there are really lots of different steps to the generalization. And so I don't think it's a full answer to the bully question. I kind of agree with Nick that it needs to be more in a natural setting, but it can be introduced, I think, in ABA. But, again, unless you have that generalization piece,
yeah,
then it is just a drill. I totally agree with you there.
And let me clarify. I mean, I think I agree. If somebody is doing ABA well, it will generalize. But the majority of the time, the parents that I've talked to, not everybody does ABA the way it was meant to be, like you said.
Correct.
So I think if you can get it in a natural setting, that would be optimum, but I think maybe it can work with ABA. It just wouldn't be my first choice.
Right. I understand exactly what you're saying. Okay, here's Jennifer in Buffalo. I am wondering what your thoughts are on disclosure with children in late elementary or middle school. My son was not diagnosed until late, fifth grade, and the school he attended at the time told us he was teased because children didn't understand him and that if they only knew, he would be treated better by his peers. We felt that kids at that age would simply have more reason to bully him and choose not to disclose the information. Oh, and we chose not to disclose the information. I am all about educating children on various forms of learning disabilities and how they can affect children, but feel it is up to the school systems to embrace different learning styles and meet all the children's needs, regardless of any difficulties they may face. Because these are bright children, they are often labeled as lazy or immature. He is now in a public school that has a special program for children with Asperger's and autism, and he is doing quite well. We were reluctant to place him in a special ed program at this point. He is now in eighth grade because we were concerned that either he would regress or it would be difficult due to the peer issues at this already difficult time in adolescence. The reason he has been able to do so well, however, is because he is supported and so well understood. If the teachers are all supportive of the children with any special needs, I feel that the other children follow their lead.
And that seems to be a comment that this woman was making, and I agree. I mean, I think if disclosure is done well, ultimately that is what will happen. I've heard of some instances where disclosure is made and then the child is ostracized, not kind of in a bullying kind of way, but, ooh, he's weird, let's stay away from him. So it can kind of backfire, but I think if disclosure is done well, the child feels good about him or herself, differences are embraced, and it's not like the end of the world if somebody has Asperger's. They function a little bit differently. You know, I think that's the key, Chantal, now that I'm verbalizing it out loud, is that we don't make it into such a dramatic production of, now he's an alien from outer space, we've got to really treat him differently. No, it's
right.
Kind of like, you know what I mean? He functions a little bit differently, and maybe that's even the wrong way to say it, but just, you know, there's different things, but look at somebody like Albert Einstein, who created the theory of relativity. He was a little bit different at school, and a lot of people thought that he couldn't learn. So teaching it in that sort of way, where it's not over-dramatized, I think is really important.
Right. Okay, so now here's a really long statement question from Liz in Audubon, New Jersey.
Okay.
When is verbal abuse considered bullying by law? What's the fine line between someone just being plain mean as opposed to crossing that line into verbal bullying? I need examples and or a reference to go on. If this is happening at public school, when should a parent speak with a school official about this after the first verbal bullying incident? And which school official is best to speak with in order to get things resolved? Okay, that's the start. I don't know if you want me to continue and read everything and then go back over the questions one by one.
Yeah, I'll kind of answer that first question. As I said earlier, I mean, it depends on where you live, and each state defines it differently. And I have these definitions in front of me. I'm not going to read every one, but each school kind of, or not school, each state kind of lays out what they define as bullying. So you kind of have to look at the state that you live in for those guidelines, because each state is going to be different.
Yeah, you know, it sounds like from all the questions this person has in here, she really needs to have some legal advice. And this is in New Jersey. I don't really know the name of the organization in New Jersey, but every single state has a protection and advocacy agency. And, well, in California, it's called Protection Advocacy, but in every state there is one. And these are people who translate the special education laws into lay language for parents to be able to understand. And they're usually translated into a zillion different languages as well. And the whole point is so that everyone knows what their rights are. And if you go online in your state and look up Protection Advocacy, you should be able to find it. If it's not exactly that same name, you will find something just by looking up, you know, My Special Education Rights.
Yeah, and actually, I'm sorry to interrupt.
Go ahead.
But I was going to say to Liz that she should go to bullypolice.org/nj-law.html, because that I just did a quick search online as we were talking, and that pretty much gives the guidelines for what is considered. For example, quote-unquote, harassment, intimidation, or bullying means any gesture in New Jersey, means any gesture or written, verbal, or physical act that is reasonably perceived as being motivated either by an actual or perceived characteristic such as race, color, religion, ancestry, national origin, gender, sexual orientation, gender identity. So it gets very, very specific, and there's like 3 or 4 pages of it. So let me repeat it again just in case you didn't write it down the first time. It's Bully Police, www.bullypolice.org/nj-law.html, and that sort of spells it out for you.
Yeah, and it goes on with Liz's question. She talks about whether the child would have more protection under a 504 or an IEP. I think that's the kind of thing you really need legal advice in your state. And again, often in these states under protection advocacy, there's often someone that you can talk to for free. At least the way it works in the state of California is you have to leave a message, and they don't get back to you for 2 or 3 days. So you really have to plan ahead of your IEP or whatever meeting you're having with the school. But I would definitely check in your state, and I think that's really good advice to look at what Nick's just given you. But I hate to get more into it because I'm not an attorney, and I don't think, Nick, you're not an attorney either, are you?
No, my dad's an attorney, but I decided not to go that way in life.
Well, we're certainly glad that you've decided not to. Okay, so let me see. We have so many more questions here. Okay, here's from LD in Los Angeles. How should we respond if during a meeting with one child's IEP team, they react with silence when you say you are concerned with unkind treatment and bullying?
Boy, again, as Chantel alluded to earlier, I think that you should document that and save whatever reactions that anyone had or whatever anybody said. I think you should be writing it down and be saving it for future use. And again, in California, my understanding is that there is a law on the books which mandates them to do something about it. So you can even pull out that law, do some research, maybe go on the Bully Police website, bullypolice.org, because I think it has it for every state that has the law. That's what I just did a few seconds ago. I went on Bully Police and I pulled up New Jersey, and it had everything about New Jersey as far as what needs to be done, bully prevention programs, what the definitions are of bullying. So I think having that at the IEP meeting and saying, you need to do this by law. And when you frame it in terms of law, they're really not going to want to go to court because that costs money. It's time-consuming. So if they can do something that settles it out of court, I think that they're going to do that. And if they know that you're threatening that with that, then I think that they're going to try to appease you. That would just be my take on it.
Okay, and I'm going to respond also not as a legal person but as a parent and just a lay advocate. I would say that I would be documenting what the unkind treatment and bullying is, and if you already have those, that's great. I would ask for another meeting, and I would ask, I would give them, I think it's still 24-hour notice, but you need to check that in the state of California. You give 24-hour notice and allow to tape record, because then you can tape record the silence, or you can tape record whatever remarks they make. And I would also, because I know a lot of states, there are a lot of meetings, they're so busy that if you go in there with a plan, then you're going to have a reaction to a plan. So I think I would also come up with some ideas of here's what I'm concerned with and here's some ideas of how to resolve it, because they obviously don't have any ideas if they're reacting in silence. So that's what I would suggest. And I think that if you read Nick's book and also look at some of the websites that he's mentioned or that last one, it might give you some ideas as well. Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, my book and Rebecca Heinrich's book, I think, are both really good resources. And her book, I don't know exactly the title, but it also has to do with Asperger's and bullying, and you could look that up on Amazon.com.
Yeah, and I really like both the books. I like Nick's book because I get it from his perspective, someone who's been there. And Rebecca's might be one that a principal might be more in tune to because it really talks about it from a systems down. And sometimes they get that better if they're dealing with systems. But both of them, I think I like both of the books together. I think that you really have two really excellent tools there. I think Nick's is more practical, but the other one might be something that systems people more relate to. I don't know if I'm explaining myself correctly there.
No, that makes sense to me.
Okay, so here's Yvonne Bale from Gulfport. We have a 41-year-old son that has recently been diagnosed with Asperger's, and we also have a grandson who is autistic. Our son, so that's the 41-year-old, has turned into a giant-sized bully and will not understand why the family is mean to him. I know that it is a matter of perception on his part, but if any of us disagree with him on whatever subject, he goes into such a rage. I am frightened of him. He was also molested at the age of 9 by my babysitter's daughter. At the time, there was not a lot of information about molestation, and I was told that he was just going through early puberty and not to worry. Now, some 30-plus years later, I am at my wit's end with his behavior, and frankly, I do not want him to be around my grandson. We are becoming kinship guardian for our grandson, and he will be coming to live with us. His uncle, which is the 41-year-old son, lives only blocks away, and he appears to be very jealous of our grandson. I do not know what to do in my current situation. Is there any help? I always have hope.
Boy, that does sound like a sticky situation. And, again, I'm sorry to hear what you've gone through, and I don't know how much behavior I don't know how much I would assign to the AS. I think there probably has been some severe PTSD that's taken place as far as him being molested. You know, studies show that those who are molested are likely to molest themselves or act violently later on in life. So
if it hasn't been dealt with, that's true.
Exactly, and I think it does need to be dealt with. I'm not an expert in this area as far as handling post-traumatic stress from being molested as a child, but I definitely think that there has to be some sort of intervention or action that takes place.
Okay. It is a really tough situation. Here we go. Jerry LaVallee from Orlando. I honestly believe that the more people become familiar with Asperger's syndrome, the more they will appreciate what creative, bright people they are. When we go places, we usually run into someone who knows our son from school, church, etc. They always have a smile and a happy greeting for him. This always amazes us because we have the day-to-day care of him and forget what a cheerful boy he can be. That does not mean that he doesn't get bullied. He does. Our problem is that when he comes home, he bullies his younger brothers the same way he was bullied. He doesn't even understand some of the gestures or words that he is using. How do we stop him from passing on the bullying? That's the second question that kind of somebody else had kind of asked that same question before, too.
Yeah, well, let me address the first question first. I think it is true that once you meet someone with AS, you sort of have a different appreciation about what AS is. But there's also the saying that, you know, if you've met one person on the spectrum, you've only met one person on the spectrum. So we are a very diverse group of people, and we're as diverse as neurotypicals are from each other, in my opinion. And so, yes, I think that the more of us can kind of be out there, even as children, 9, 10, 11 years old, and kind of express who we are, the more there's going to be an appreciation for people like us, especially if it's facilitated properly in the classroom with teachers. You know, I have a cousin who is the head usher at his temple. He is in charge of Homeless Week, and he's a hero at his temple. And people know about his Asperger's, but they don't really appreciate him because of his Asperger's. They appreciate who he is as a person. And I think that's the important thing, is to look at who we are holistically. We're not just our diagnosis. We're much more than that. But I think knowing about the diagnosis really kind of gives us insight into who we are and makes you kind of appreciate that there isn't an autistic stereotype, that we are individuals and we're capable of greatness just like anyone else is. So.
Okay, so that's the first part. And the second part is, how do we stop him from passing on the bullying? In other words, he gets bullied at school, and then he comes home and does the same thing that happened to him earlier.
Well, you know, a lot of that is going to be projection. And that's basically a Freudian term. But when I was at school, I would get bullied a lot, and then I would come home, and having kept myself together throughout the course of the day because I didn't want to have a meltdown at school, I then unleashed it all on my parents because they were my target. They were who I could direct my energy to. All the energy that I would have wanted to direct towards my targets or my the bullying who were targeting me, it was being displaced onto my parents. So displacement is what I was looking for, not projection. So basically, you know, you want to give the child opportunities to let out that frustration, whether it be buying a punching bag. I always recommend exercise as a good way to do that, whether it be, you know, letting him swim in the pool. Swimming seems to really help kids with autism. Ways to kind of get that aggression out, but in a healthy way, rather than displacing the anger that they've had to hold together all day long on the bullies, and they take it out on you. And that's pretty common among those with autism and Asperger's. We hold it together all day long, and then we get home, and who are our targets? Our siblings and our parents. So I really think that having other outlets for that anger can be really, really helpful.
Good. Thank you for that. Denise Jackal in New York. How do parents handle it if children use all the techniques and the ones who are socially acceptable don't want to lose their status by associating with the victim and just remain neutral or join in or just be a bystander because, again, they don't want to lose their status? And those kids would wind up being left out as well. What do we tell our kids?
That's a great question, Denise, and that's what I addressed earlier in the conversation as far as having a whole school approach and having the kids have the mindset that bullying other children is not acceptable. And if they see somebody doing it, they would intuitively come to the aid of the person who's being victimized, where it wouldn't be seen as being uncool. You know, if you think about it, if only one person is coming to the aid of the victim, there's kind of a risk involved in that because I don't want to do anything on my own. I want group support. If I have group support, then I'm not the only one doing it. So there's safety in numbers and there's strength in numbers. And when you can get a group of people to confront the bully rather than just one person, you're setting up a situation where the bully is going to find it a lot harder to do what he's previously been doing. And it's kind of like what we would do as adults. I mean, if we saw a mother abusing her child, we would probably take action. We'd call protective services or we'd call the police. We would intuitively do the right thing probably. And that's what we need to teach children is that if they see something like that, they need to do the right thing. And I think, again, as I said earlier, it's already within them to do this. We just need to remind them what the right thing to do is. And we kind of need to decondition them from what they've learned instinctively from their peers. And I think that people with AS kind of instinctively know how to do this. They're the ones who usually are the ones who come forward and say, Jimmy is being teased by John or, you know, I mean, again, they're the little policemen. They want to see justice prevail. And I think that almost if we could use the example of someone with AS and say, this is what people should be doing, let's follow Tim's lead, we can kind of place him in a positive light in that regard. Whereas a lot of teachers, I think, view that as being tattling or starting trouble or something along those lines.
Great. Joan in Bimington. How do you help teenagers with Asperger's syndrome understand that someone who has been bullying them is not truly their friend? Gosh, I get this one a lot at conferences when I speak on adolescent issues. We have teenagers with Asperger's syndrome who have such a difficult time coming to grips with the fact that their typical peers who seemingly befriend them but are in fact telling them to do inappropriate acts and ridiculing them. Our students continually go back to those who bully them and continue to be bullied time and again. I just wanted to make a comment that also this has come to my attention around the country. People have come and told me stories about what happens to their kids at school. And I'm bringing this up because one area that parents don't like to deal with too much is explaining to their kids about sexuality and sex and what is sex. Mm-hmm. And those issues are really important because that's how some of the bullying happens that I've heard of is where, for example, a teenage girl will want to be friends with these other teenage girls, and she thinks that they're befriending her, and what they're doing is telling her to go to see Johnny and perform a sex act. Now, she doesn't realize it's a sex act, and she doesn't realize it's inappropriate. I know many neurotypical people listening right now are going to be thinking, oh, my God, how could that be? But it's true. If you don't tell people something and explain to people, especially with Asperger's, there are things they don't really get. And so these people get not only bullied but abused, because that's sexual abuse. I'm sorry. And so it's really important, and I'll let Nick answer that question, but I wanted to make sure that I tell parents out there that even if you think your kids are not interested in sex or the sex act, you need to clarify what those are to teenagers, because even if they're not interested, they're going to be hearing about it. Don't you agree, Nick?
Oh, absolutely, and that's something I actually really hadn't thought of, but I think it's a really good point, is that especially in middle school and high school, sex becomes a main topic of conversation among students. I mean, it's on people's brains, so to speak. So, that would be something that people would use against those who are gullible to get them to do humiliating things, and that is sexual abuse. I really hadn't thought of that, but that's a really great point.
I've heard quite a few stories across the country because I'm speaking on adolescent issues, and so that's why they ask me about that. But I'm not trying to scare parents. I'm just saying, you know, to be proactive about these kind of things. So now to answer this question, what do you do about teaching the teenagers with Asperger's who are having a difficult time coming to grip with the fact that their typical peers who seemingly befriend them are, in fact, telling them to do inappropriate things and ridiculing them?
That's a tough one, and again, I think it's a matter of teaching people the black and white rule that not everybody who is friendly to you is your friend, and I think that that's something that people with Asperger's have a hard time accepting because, you know, if somebody's friendly to me, they're my friend. I mean, there's kind of a rigidity in thought, and I think people really have to look at the big picture and ask themselves again, has this person been friendly to me before? What they're asking me to do, have I ever been asked to do this before? If not, it might not be something that I should do. You know, does it sound like a typical request? So people with AS, I think, really have to think about these things mechanically, but they have to think about them instead of just go along with what people tell them. And I think if you tap into the logic, the inherent logic that people with AS use, you can really have some good results as far as teaching them these social rules. And you can pretty much teach them that anything that you're asked to do of a sexual nature, and you can, I mean, I know it's uncomfortable for parents to talk about this issue, but sometimes it needs to be talked about to avoid a humiliating situation. And you can kind of go through it and say, you know, don't ever do that. If anyone asks you to do that, I don't care how friendly they are or how much they entice you or what they want to give you for doing it or how cool you'll be if you do it, just don't do it.
I also think in terms of these other things that are non-sexual but someone has a hard time figuring out if they're appropriate or not appropriate, if the parent sees that this kind of thing is going on where the judgment still isn't there because they don't really know, and you can't as a parent know absolutely everything that's going to be happening in the school day, I like the idea that Zosia Zak comes up with. Do you know Zosia Zak? Are you familiar with her book, Nick?
I believe so. I think she's on the board of GRASP, if I'm not mistaken.
Correct.
She wrote a book, Love.
What is the name of the book?
Love, Life, and Learning or something like that. I don't know if I got the title exactly correct. But
well, I'm having a senior moment, and I can see the book, and I know it's green, and I know it's by Zosia Zak. It's Life and Love or Love and Life and Strategies. Or Living with Autism or something like that. But if you put Zosia Zak, Zosia Zaks, she has a great idea, and that is that you have a friend or you have a peer. And there are some good people in all these situations and at school. And you teach, and this is good for when they're adults as well and they're living on their own, but this person with Asperger's has someone that they go to say, here's what's been proposed to me. Is this an appropriate thing to do? Is this a safe thing for me to do? Okay? And so then in those situations, they can either go to that person or over time they're going to learn enough of these situations to know that it's not a good thing. So that way they can check things out. As an adult, it becomes really important, especially if people are living on their own, and let's say they decide they want to date, so they go online dating, and then somebody makes an appointment to meet them somewhere at night. You know, like your apartment. Well, the that friend that they have could tell them, well, you know, that's not such a good thing if you're going to meet someone for the first time that you've never met before. Meet them at a Starbucks in broad daylight, you know, for an hour at 10 o'clock. That's it. You know, they have to learn those rules of, you know, it's probably not a good thing to go to somebody's house that you've never met before, that you just met online.
Exactly.
But she's got some really good tips like that. Don't you think that it would be really nice to have a friend like that at school?
Absolutely. And, again, that kind of goes along the lines of what I was speaking about regarding the whole peer mentoring thing, that if a mentor could be used in that capacity, especially in the high school years, to run those kinds of questions by that person, especially if the person with AS doesn't really have that many friends to begin with, this is kind of like the go-to person or their go-to people if there's more than one mentor. Because these aren't things that you're going to run by your parents. A lot of these questions are very personal.
Right.
And you don't talk about sexual things with your mother if you're a guy, typically. So, yeah, I think it's invaluable, and I think that's – I think I remember reading that from her book, but that's a good, great strategy.
I have – I'm going to share a little something personal here because I just – it's just really funny, and I had never thought about this before, but my son's 20, and he's looking for love and a girlfriend, not necessarily both the same place. Anyway, so – the thing is when you're a parent, you know that your children are going through this, but usually if you have a neurotypical child, it's like, you know, they don't share certain aspects with you. And so my son, I now have him going to see a therapist every other week where he can discuss these things and maybe evolve in a certain direction, whatever that may be. Well, the last time we went, he picked up my handbag and took me to the door and said he wanted to go because we'd been there, I don't know, four or five times. And he said it wasn't working because she hadn't got him a girlfriend yet. And he's also mad at me because I haven't, like, gone to the store and gotten him a girlfriend. And I usually get him therapies, so he hasn't quite understood why he hasn't gotten that girlfriend yet because we're working on it. So it's supposed to happen now. So it gets a little hard when you're a parent. You know, you get to these certain areas, and it's funny because I speak to everybody about these adolescent issues. But especially when you have a child who's nonverbal, it's like he has to have – someone who communicates with him to be able to write his personal journal or communicate with a therapist. And mom wants to be out of the picture. So you have to find a trusted person who he can be having his discussions with or, you know, maybe doing some online dating with, because I don't want to be, it's not that I don't want to be, but, you know, he needs a little freedom. Who wants your mom doing that for you?
And so, it helps to foster independence when you can go to somebody besides your parents because, you know, you kind of have a life of your own, and it's not like the person, other person is making all the decisions for you, but everyone kind of needs a friend to run things by. I mean, I don't think it's unique so much to people with AS.
No, it's not, but it's interesting because, as you say, with AS, they have, you don't have all those things that people know or take for granted through osmosis in place. And so it is difficult, not difficult, but it is something to think about. Who is that person going to be that you're going to trust when it comes to those more intimate areas of your life?
Exactly. And I think that a parent can maybe even do some searching and maybe go on the GRASP website and email somebody from GRASP and say, hey, is there somebody who my son can run something by if the situation
right.
comes up? And even, you know, so if finding somebody at the school is going to be a difficult thing, then there might have to be some legwork that needs to be done and some creative solutions that need to follow. But, you know, that's what I would suggest.
Yeah, and that's what's great about the Internet is you can find resources more easily. I mean, it takes a lot of legwork out of the research.
Exactly.
Okay, here is Jen from Canada. I am worried about my 7-year-old daughter with Asperger's as she is wanting to fit in and seems to be taken advantage of by her peers. Again, it's the same type of question, though she's younger. She does not seem to understand what a healthy friendship is. Is there a way to help her understand and learn assertiveness? I'm especially worried about her when she gets older and can become easily victimized by boys. She has extreme difficulty with personal boundaries.
Well, again,
I have one suggestion here. I don't know. Of course, I'm not you, Nick, but go ahead.
No, I'd like to hear yours first, and then I'll piggyback off of that.
Okay, well, I've and I don't do this, I don't recommend this just for people with Asperger's. I recommend it for, you know, anybody on the spectrum who does not always understand what's appropriate or inappropriate. So I always suggest to parents that they teach, they have an icon with, a picture icon with someone who's got, you know, like a stick figure with clothes on it, and it says public, and then you have an icon with a stick figure who's just wearing underwear, and it says private. And when they're little, you teach them public and private. So, like, for example, after a certain age, they're not supposed to be running around the house naked. So that's a private behavior that you do in your bathroom and in your bedroom. Okay, so then when they get around to when they're doing things such as masturbation, okay, that's a private behavior in your bedroom. It's not something you do elsewhere in the house. Or doing certain behaviors that are appropriate in your home but are not appropriate out in public. So you learn about private behaviors and public behaviors. And then you also learn, as you get older, you can apply those to conversations. Like there are certain conversations you have in private and there are certain conversations that you have in public. And so when for someone who's that little, who's seven, you can start working in that idea of public and private, you know, which then becomes, you know, appropriate or inappropriate. And that kind of helps with the personal boundaries, because then you can also teach, like, here are the appropriate things, you know, or this is okay to do with the private circle of people, and your private circle is who's at home. And then you have the big hug circle, which might be your uncles and aunts and people you know really well. And then there's the handshake circle. Those are people that you know at school. Well, things that are appropriate at home but in private are not out in public. And so you kind of teach them a little hierarchy of things so they have this thing to think about as they get older. But that is just a general way of setting a foundation.
Yeah, I think that's a great strategy. I mean, it involves the visual modality, which we know many people with Asperger's are much stronger visually as far as what they learn. It's very concrete, and it's kind of like the 5-point system, similar to that.
Right.
So, yeah, I mean, I think that's a great strategy, and the more concrete it can be, the more easily learnable it'll be. So that's a great answer, Chantal.
And the thing about learning assertiveness, I think you kind of went over that before, but did you want to talk more about how? Because I think when you were talking about assertiveness, you said where if they could learn the key answers that they give to a bully. But in this situation, she's not talking about bullying, but she's talking about in a friendship. You know how you have to sometimes be assertive about, you know, the boundaries? Do you have any suggestions for that?
When you say the boundaries as far as overstepping boundaries?
Well, she said she, in here, the only thing I know is that she said her child has extreme difficulty with personal boundaries. So she's afraid of her being victimized, but right now she wants her to learn assertiveness. So there's not really any, it's not assertiveness to stand her ground against a bully. It's just already to learn naturally to be assertive.
Okay, so if I understand the question correctly, she's worried that her daughter won't know what to do if she's in a situation where she can't be assertive enough to say no to whoever's coming out or, you know, bullying her or doing something that she doesn't want done to her. Is that kind of what she's asking?
Yeah, because she doesn't seem to understand what a healthy friendship is, so she wants her to understand what a healthy friendship is and learn assertiveness, which is what you need for a healthy friendship, you know, so someone's
right.
Not dominating the relationship.
Exactly.
You know, because it's a seven-year-old, like, and that's how sometimes they get dragged into situations because they don't know how to assert themselves.
Right. I guess the way that I would teach assertiveness is to just tell your daughter that sometimes saying no, if she has a problem with saying no, sometimes you just have to teach that child to say the word no. And it can be difficult if you're so used to trying to appease people. And sometimes I find that with people with Asperger's, because they don't have a lot of friends, they go out of their way to kind of appease people because they want friends. And I think sometimes we need to be reminded that not everything that everybody's asking of us is a good thing. So saying no, I think, can even gain respect from our peers, because if we're always saying yes, then we, you know, people view us as not really having a backbone, so to speak. So I think being assertive and standing one's ground is really important.
Good. Okay, now here's an interesting comment and a question from Jeff in Tualatin. Are we really born good, as you stated? Empathy, like safety. What?
This came in as we were actually doing our interview.
Right.
Okay.
Are we really born good, as you stated? Empathy, like safety, is at the bottom of any survival skill, so this should change our global teaching assessment. The morality and ethical product we hope for everyone is acquired over time. Asperger's syndrome results in misaligned thought processes. Approaching the learning process by assuming a person is good is distorting their actual needs, inhibiting an ongoing critical review.
Well, you know, I tend to look at it in a positive way, and I think that when I see young children who have not been exposed to a school setting, that you will notice that they do say things like, "Are you okay?" or you know, they do things that they're conditioned once they get into school not to do because of peer pressures or whatever. So I really do believe that it is a matter of unlearning certain behaviors that we learn from our peers in order to gain popularity. I mean, I really think it's as simple as that. And I think when you look at all the educational models that assume that children are good, we're talking about, you know, a lot of the progressive schools that do that. I think John Dewey had the philosophy that humans are born good, and his model was very progressive. So that's kind of how I view human beings. I don't think we're born evil. I think that I don't subscribe to that view. And, you know, I mean, everybody believes differently, so you can take whatever approach that you want to, but that's just my personal opinion.
Very good. Okay, here's a question from Jean in Tennessee. What type of school do you recommend for Asperger's, private, public, or special centers? I homeschooled but would like a year off to attend college, and I'm struggling with the decision, and none of our schools have chill rooms because they feel they would abuse the privilege of this. Our public schools all work to mainstream to put kids in the bigger classrooms, and we need to stay in smaller settings to not get stressed out. What cities are the best to live in for schools and therapies? Thanks.
I'm not sure about cities. I know that there are some good schools in New York. I think Sarah Boris used to work at
right.
And do you know the name of that school off the top of your head?
No, because it changed names. It was also associated with Valerie Paradis.
Yes, yes.
Valerie Paradis started it. But if you contact GRASP, because Sarah Boris is now working at GRASP,
mm-hmm.
She might be able to tell the people or the person where how to contact that school. It changed names, but it does still exist, and it's in upstate New York. That's one place. You're correct.
And I think that just in general, it really depends on the person. I mean, I'm pretty much in favor of inclusion when it can happen, but when the situation is escalating to abuse and nobody's doing anything about it, sometimes it is good to be around people who you have a lot in common with. And, you know, I've met a lot of kids who attend schools where there are other people with ASD, nonverbal learning disability, and they see how much in common they have with these other kids, and it really accelerates the learning process too at the same time. Mm-hmm. So, and then there are other people who decide to homeschool their children, and some people will say, well, aren't you taking away socialization opportunities by doing that? And what I would say is no, they can still be involved in their favorite activities. They can still gain valuable social practice, but it just doesn't have to be in an abusive setting. So they can still go to camp. They can still, you know, if they like tennis, they can still go to tennis lessons. And they can meet and play with and socialize with other kids. They're just not doing it in a school setting. So I'm not really even against homeschooling.
Mm-hmm. Now we have time for one more question. And it's not really specific about bullying, but I think it's kind of related, and it's a good question. Jill from Villanova, my 11-year-old son still engages in a clapping, shouting, self-stimulatory behavior. He tries to control it but cannot stop completely. He knows his friends accept it, but he is aware that it is ruining his reputation with kids who don't know him. How have other kids handled these situations? you know, having a STEM that is not so acceptable.
I can tell you that the urge to STEM, at least in my case, never really goes away. So one thing you might have to accept as a parent is part of the experience of having ASD is that there is an urge to STEM. I've just learned over the years not to do it in public. So when I go to my condominium, I'm able to STEM as much as I want because I'm in the privacy of my own home. I sometimes tell adults who STEM in the workplace that if they really need to STEM, take themselves out of that setting for a few minutes, maybe go to the bathroom, go to their car, and do it. So I really think that maybe you need to teach your child that STEMming isn't inherently wrong because I don't think that the child should be shamed for it. I think that's one more thing that they could internalize as being bad about themselves, and I think that that's not a good thing. But I think, again, like Chantel was saying about certain places are acceptable to do and, you know, certain things are acceptable in public and certain things are acceptable in private, and STEMming just as a matter of course isn't really something that people do in public. And if you teach the child that, then maybe they can control themselves, even though I know that there are sensory issues and environmental issues that cause the STEMming to happen, such as, you know, bright lights or loud, high-pitched noises that cause the STEMming. But you just really have to kind of teach it fundamentally, like certain places are okay. If you can hold it in for maybe a couple extra minutes, there's a big sensory room waiting for you with a big trampoline and a tire swing, and, you know, ideally if a school had that equipment. But that's kind of what I'm saying.
Yeah, that's a good point. And I think that they're trying to find a STEM that could replace the one that looks so obvious.
Mm-hmm.
Or, you know, that you can do secretly that people can't really tell is one thing. But also, at 11-year-olds, I mean, he's still just learning how to self-regulate. I would hope that there's room in his program to have a sensory break or that he's allowed to take a break and go off and have a place to do, you know, the STEM that he needs to do. Because I know it's hard to do something like that in public if you're going to turn off all these people who could be potentially friends. But on the other hand, it is definitely a need. So I would see if you could fit in to school that he can do that. Like with Jeremy now, we have rules where he's transferred as carrying around an age-appropriate book or a guitar magazine, but then he can go off, you know, every couple of hours and have, you know, a little STEM time with a piece of string, you know. And at home, he can do the STEMming, but when it's work time or we're out in public, the book comes out and the STEM toy goes away. You know, we just have rules about it, but he still gets time to STEM. It's necessary.
And there may be kids who actually do a better job of learning when they're standing up. I mean, like, for example, I couldn't learn unless I was pacing around. So, like, during study hall, I was allowed to pace, and it kind of became normal after a while because people got used to it. And after a while, it wasn't that big of a deal. And I would be able to kind of take in the information much more easily. If somebody had said to me, sit down, don't move, look at your book, be still, that wouldn't have worked. So I think sometimes we have to accommodate the needs of these kids and say to ourselves, if they're going to learn better doing it their way, not our way, let's do it their way, and let's see if we'll get results that way.
That's great. Well, Dr. Nick Dubin, this is the only time we have now. We're going to have to stop now. I think you got practically all the questions, which is great. I would like to repeat for everyone your website, which is www.aspergerwisdom.com, and also the names of your books. The newest one is Asperger Syndrome and Anxiety, and the one which is the topic for today is Asperger Syndrome and Bullying. And thank you so much for being on the show, Nick.
You're very welcome. Thank you for inviting me, Chantel.
You are welcome. So this has been a webinar on MomsFightingAutism.com. Our next webinar will be on August 25th, and our guest will be Dr. Cynthia Norell, who has a new book being published, which is about social skills. So next month will be about social skills. Thank you again, Nick, and for everyone out there, go out there and be the change that you want to see, and enjoy the rest of your summer. Thank you.